Okay, we'll get started. Good morning, everybody. I want to welcome Rachel Huberger, who is the librarian, as you'll soon see, in Frankfurt am Main. I can't pronounce her official title. My German doesn't allow me to do so. But anyways, it's a pleasure to have her here. Really being, I think, a unique perspective on Shinshon Raphael Hirsch and the community in which he lived in the 19th century in Frankfurt, of course, as you all know, where his career really it flourished. And Dr. Huberger has been in Germany for 27 years. She grew up in Israel, a graduate of Hebrew University, and she has one of her children with her in Germany and one at Columbia University, who's right here. I want to welcome them. So without further ado, in the interest of time, I want to introduce you to speak on the library in Frankfurt. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So let me first begin in thanking Torah in Motion for bringing me over, for giving me this opportunity here to talk to you and to show you a little bit what's going on in Frankfurt, how it was in the 19th century, how it is today, and to present you my library, the library I'm working in, which is one of the largest Judaica collection in the world, I could say. It is the largest collection in Germany, and it's connected to Hirsch in this way that it was founded at the same time when Hirsch was staying in Frankfurt and was acting as a rabbi. As you truly hear, English is not my mother tongue, so I please excuse the sometimes if I have to look for words. So I want to show you and give you an overview about this library. Here you see how it looks today. And that's what I want to show you in short. I will go into the history, how the library came into existence, how it was formed by its famous director, Arnold Freimann, who made it to the library it is today, this large collection. The fate of the library during National Socialism, how it survived, so that we still have it today and can use it. And then I show you some of the historic collections that survived and what we do with them today in order to bring them nearer to the students to make research easier. So, this library was found in the 19th century in the from donations given by German Jews to the Frankfurt Library. We are talking about the library that is not part of the Jewish community, but it's the official library of the town of Frankfurt. And in the 19th century, Jews were becoming gradually equal citizens in Germany. So in Frankfurt, they wanted to show, they were sure that when they would show the people what Judaism is and what the Jewish culture, then they could fight against anti-Semitism and against thoughts against the Jews, against prejudice against the Jews. So they deliberately gave money or gave their legacies of books also to the library of the town. Now, I just want to recall that Frankfurt, the characteristic of Frankfurt Jewish community, that's the only community in Germany with a continuity. It's the only community that you have, it's not the oldest community, communities like Cologne, or the communities of what you call Kehilot Shum, you know, Mainz, and Vermeiser, Magenta, Vermeiser, Spielspeyer, as it's called today in Germany, they were much older, they came to the Romans. But Frankfurt is a community from the 12th century, 1150 something about, which has, there has always been Jews in Frankfurt until National Socialism. So that made it a center for Jewish learning, for Torah learning. And it also developed within the Frankfurt Jewish community, within the people, a very, very strong sense of being Frankfurters. Until today, and I think if you meet people who come or are descendants from Frankfurt Jewish community, they have this feeling that there's nothing special. And that's why in the 19th century, these Jewish families, which could look back on a long history of living in Frankfurt, of not moving around, they felt as part of the town and wanted to do something for their town. So they developed a very intensive philanthropy. And part of the philanthropy was to give to the town, to the university library, their collections. As I said, so that non-Jews, maybe close the door, so that non-Jewish scholars could learn and read about Judaism, about what's Jewish life about. So the beginning of the library were the donations of famous Frankfurt Jews. It's either their books, like Isaac Marcus Jost, who was a reform, if you want, he was a counterpart of Samson Raphaël. He was teaching at the philanthropy. Or they were donations by rich Jews who bought the libraries from rabbis and brought them to the library. And I think the wealth of Frankfurt is known to everybody by the name of Rothschild, that, you know, the banker family, who comes from Frankfurt, from the Frankfurt ghetto, who dispersed into the whole world, and is a synonym for Jewish wealth, for banking business. But they were just one. There were many, many banking families, because Frankfurt was a town of fairs, and you needed to change money. So the banking business developed in Frankfurt. So this is the Rothschild in the 19th century. The last Rothschild living in Frankfurt was Wilhelm Karl von Rothschild, called Baron Willi. And he was the last also Orthodox Rothschild. The other sons, having gone to London and Paris, Vienna, they left the Orthodoxy, but he stayed, and he died in 1901. He was a very, very rich person. So he donated it, and when he died in 1901, his widow gave all his private library, all the books that have not yet been in the library, she donated to this, to Dyker collection. And here you see for his 17th birthday, he got a present from the community of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, being a donator to both Jewish communities. Now the man that formed this, or that used these donations and formed them into the library we have today, is Aaron Freimann. And I think what you can say about this library is that it's a combination, a mixture of wealth of the Jewish bankers giving the money or buying the books, a readiness of the town, the city hall, to accept this donation, to take them into the central library, and a professionalism. And so these combinations, that we had a time where all these three factors played together, they formed this library, this collection. And the man was Aaron Freimann. He comes from Poland, from Eastern, today Poland, but then East Germany. He was the grandson of Rabbi Ettlinger. He's a very famous man. He's a bibliographer. He wrote a lot about Jewish history, about Jewish books. He studied in Berlin at the Rabbiner Seminar, and then he came to Frankfurt, and he became also the son-in-law of Marcus Horowitz, the rabbi of the Frankfurt community, meaning he had very good connections to all the influential people. So you had a setting of professionalism with the possibility to enter into these circles. That's how he got to Rothschild, and he had contact with the widow man when Baron Willi died, and contact to other very rich people. So he formed this library. And then in Vienna, he was also active in communal politics. He prayed in the famous Bernerplatz Synagogue, and he was a member of the Frankfurt Jewish Community Council, and became by chance to be the last chairman of the Jewish community in 1938. Both communities then existing in Frankfurt, the Ausdrucksgemeinde, Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, and the Jewish community of Frankfurt, they had to cooperate, or they were put together, they were connected by the Nazis, they were dissolved in their autonomy, they were put together in 1938, and he became the chairman of this community. He had to sign the treaties, we have his signature under the treaties, when in 1939 the Jewish community had to hand over all their possessions of land, all their properties, to the Frankfurt government, and now already then, of course, under National Socialism. He managed in 1939, he managed to come to the United States through London, and the reason, in the United States there were of course refugee help organizations who tried to bring over scholars. They did not succeed as much as they wanted because the United States had a very restrictive immigration policy in those years. But he came over, he was over 70 years old already, and it was written that he is the best known Jewish bibliography in the world. That's why they enabled him to get a scholarship to live in New York in this old age, and he continued to work in the New York, New York Public Library until he died in 48.
So what did you do for that
journey? 39. He was able in 39. Yes. If you have any question, please ask me. He was able to leave in April 39. And there is also in the New York Public Library, in the New York Times, when he came, there is a little record that the famous bibliographer arrived in New York. Here you see him in the library in 1927, before National Socialism. He became the title also professor in from the Prussian Ministry in 1919. And here you see him standing, that's him with the glasses, near the head of the library. The head of the library, that's really, I guess you want to say, irony of history, was one of the very few staunch National Socialists in librarianship. He didn't join the party because he had to, but he joined him already in 27. So he was working already, and the Freiburg was working under very bad conditions, but he managed to work. So when the Nazis came to power in 33, because Frankfurt was such a known Jewish community, and there was about 10% Jews in the town. The town had the name of being a Jewish town in Germany. So in 33, a new mayor was elected, who was a Nazi, and he wanted to change the name of this town. There is a story, it's true, that when Hitler came to visit Frankfurt in 35, he didn't stay overnight, because he said, I'm not going to stay in such a Jewish, as you said, for you, it's a town, in such a town, the Jews had such an influence. Not only as bankers, but also in the university, because the university was founded by Jewish money in order to enable Jewish professors to get tenureship in this town. So the Nazi mayor had to think about something, or he wanted to change the name, and one of the things he knew, that he had this wonderful Judaica and Hebraica collection, which was then already one of the greatest in the world. So he used this collection in order to bring into the town an institute for the research of Judaism, but of course under the direction of the Nazis. So in the 30s he tried and the Nazis put up an institute called the Institut der Forschung der Judenfrage. Where they wanted to research, as you say, families, the real Judaism, to see what Judaism is about. And maybe you know that they had in Prague, they had a Jewish museum. They wanted to kill Jews, but they wanted to leave their artifacts. So they planned to have the museum in Prague, where you could go there and see, you know, what these Jews did in their ritual and what was their culture. And in Frankfurt would become the center for the books. So Frankfurt became the books, and the mayor said it has to be in Frankfurt because here we have already this collection. So we can use the collection in order to build up this library. So in the 30s there were some trials to bring the books to Jerusalem. Schocker tried to bring the Hebrew books, the books that were written in Hebrew letters, to the then Hebrew University in its beginning, to the National Library. He did not succeed because all kinds of problems of Jewish community, there were books donated by Jews, it was part of the city property. But in the end, the books were stayed in Frankfurt, and they were part of this institute, but they were not moved to the institute. They stayed in the library. So it was only theoretically that they were part of the institute. Maybe you've heard, this institute became very notorious because in order to research this Jewish culture, they brought from East Europe all the books. They looted books, like very famous libraries from Vilna, the Strasser Library, and from Warsaw, and I think the libraries of rabbis have been searching. They brought wherever Nazis occupied Europe, there was a troop, it's like a Rosenberg, there was an organization, and they went in and they brought books, all these books, to Frankfurt in order to build up this institute. And the books that were already in Frankfurt, the historic collection, was part of it, but it was not joined together. So after the war, we had our books they stayed in Frankfurt, and the books brought to Frankfurt were then redistributed throughout the world where there were new Jewish centers, because you know the whole Jewish life, of course, in East Europe disappeared the way it was. But there are still communities, like the Jewish community in Saloniki or the Jewish community in Rome, who are looking for their libraries, for their books, and have found it. There's a famous example of Amsterdam, the Jewish Library of Amsterdam, the old Italiana, was brought to Frankfurt, but then restituted, of course, after the war.
So we are here, just an article in the paper. So we are now in the lucky situation that today, because of this irony of history, that the collection should serve national socialist research, we have a very valuable historic collection, which was partly destroyed because of the war and the bombing of Frankfurt and the trying to save the books. So Hebrew books were mostly destroyed, not all of them, but they were destroyed. And the books in non-Hebrew letter, what we call Judaica, that's the difference, they all remained intact. So we have a historic collection of Hebrew manuscripts, which were not touched by we're lucky, and the Incunabula, which are the books printed until 1500. The first books to be printed are called the cradle books, because printing is still in its beginning. We have a very interesting Yiddish collection because it's very complete. It's from the 15th century until the 19th century. And we have the collection which we call Freiman collection because of this librarian in non-Hebrew letters, in European languages, but mostly in German, because until the Second World War, German was the language of science, as you would say, they'd say English, but then it was German. So most of the books of the Wissenschaftsjudentums, of the science of Judaism, are in German. So here you see an example of one of the cradle books of the Incunabula, which was not destroyed, a Hebrew book, the Talmud printed in Soncino, one of the very first printed books at all. You know that we date the printing of books at about 1450, that's Gutenberg, founded the printing by letters, and 25 years later you have the first Hebrew books already printed in Italy in a very famous press called Soncino Press. So this is one of our oldest copies of this time. We also have a Talmud printed later, but printed in Frankfurt am Main. Frankfurt Jews were not allowed to have to own printing shops in Frankfurt, but they were allowed to print. So they had Christian printers and Jewish proofreaders, of course, checked it, and they printed many, many books in Frankfurt during the 17th, 18th century. And this is one Talmud example, as you see. Now, because we had this collection, this historic collection, after the war in 1948, when the German government decided to foster research and to give money, Germany didn't have a national library like maybe Canada or the States or France, where you buy all the foreign books. The German National Library only has the German books. So the rest of the collections are distributed throughout big libraries in the country, because we have a federal constitution, so every country has every state in the country has large libraries, and the subjects are divided. So Frankfurt, because of the historic collection, got the subjects for Judaism and or what you could do is studies and Israel. So you know this is the place where I should buy all the books that appear that are published worldwide in all languages. So if somebody in Germany needs a book concerning the topic is either Judaism, Jewish studies or Israel, and he doesn't find it in his library because he couldn't buy it, then he knows it will be in Frankfurt. And then he can order it and be sent it through interlibrary loan, or today you send it of course as a microfilm or as a PDF through computer. And that's why we get our money, not from the library itself also, but not only, but we are funded by the German Research Foundation, which is a state from the federal government, this an organization. And the reason is, of course, because we have this old historic collection. Here, I don't know if you can see, I just put in to show you that our computer put in what do we have about Jews in Canada. So you can see there are many, you know, actually over many books and I think also quite new books too.
Right.
Okay. So, and if you give in, for example, Jerusalem, you have 3,400, you know, books. You have, of course, to know more specific what you want, but it's really the largest collection today. So, because we have these historic collections from before the war, and because, of course, the books are precious, and they are also very in a damaged state because of the use over 100 of years, we try to preserve them and at the same time to make it possible for people to use it as easily as they can, and that's why we put them on the computer in digitization. We had three projects. One is the Yiddish print, the other is a project of periodicals, of journals, and the third are the books, so what we call not journals but the monographs, the books from the pre-war collection. So here I'm showing some examples of the Yiddish collection, which is so famous because it covers all aspects of Jewish life. And Yiddish was, during the Middle Ages and later, was the day-to-day language. So the importance of this collection is not that it's Sifrei Kodesh, which were just for interpretation, or the Talmud, or Shulchanot, but you have books how the Jews live in their day-to-day life. And these are books, for example, you have the Etrines, books about prayer, which were used by women, which are not part of the regular prayer book. You have books about Jewish education, how do you heal if somebody is sick. You have books about anatomy, about plants. It's really the day-to-day life. You have books describing how Jews lived. And you have, of course, here you see the, one of our oldest books is the Yiddish translation of the Chumash from Cremona, from Italy. And you have the Tenarena. You have these books which are Yiddish translations of the Bible, but just the narrative part. So the women that were reading them in the afternoon, but I guess not only women, as they say today, without the laws of the Bible. Here's one of his books, Tzemach David, it's a history of the Jews, written in Yiddish. And what is also very interesting in this collection, you have some illustrations, because these were not books read, as I said, for study, but used at home, so you could illustrate. And through this illustration, you can see how the Jews really transformed their life, how they. Here, for example, this is a book about mathematics, how to count and to add the Sefer Maaseh of Choresh v'Choshev. So you get a very direct impression of Jewish life, how it was day to day. And this is, of course, important for historians, for sociologists, for everybody who wants to know how the real life was. And as I said, many of these books have illustrations. Here, for example, you see the Rosh Hashanah, one of the very old books from Prague. And these illustrations are today used in many, many publications. You can see them, they all date back to these collections. And through the computer, you can sit at home, and we have many, as you can imagine, the Yiddish experts are not all concentrated in Germany. I would say they're much more concentrated in the United States and in Israel. So now you can use this collection. You don't have to come to Frankfurt, and we will, of course, not send these books out anymore. But you can look at them through the computer, and then you can print them out, and you can do your research. One of the books in this collection is the Minhagim book, as I said, the customs with many illustrations. And here you see the lighting of the candles on Shabbat. You can make comparisons. We have one here. See, this is one book from a certain printer. And here you have on the other side, you have the same scene, but it's exactly the opposite. In another book, you have like the same scene, but things are the same and things are different. So you can see, you know, you see according to the dress and according to
and how it's shown the development also of Jewish life. Over here you have the Katah Chodesh. And here you have a Hanukkah. Maybe one, somebody knows maybe why there are only seven and not nine. I was always wondering if somebody some is missing, but that's Hanukkah because you can see. But the
missing numbers.
Maybe the artist wasn't Jewish.
Maybe, yeah, that's very good.
But you know, this should have been a correct, I mean, you know, it's a book describing and all the Machot Hanukkah and everything, so somebody should have seen. This is the Torah from Amsterdam, which was known for its printing in those years, and many books used until today, you can read print Amsterdam. It's, you know, it's printed in Amsterdam, but then of course distributed. And what I want to show you here, that by using modern techniques, you can even gain more knowledge, because you can see it better, you can enlarge, of course, the screen, and then you can see every detail, which is very difficult to see even in the original. So here we have enlarged the part, and then you see exactly what the what's in this little sign. And this is Yossi Pond, this is a separate, the book about the Jewish history, and here we tried, when we did the digitization, we tried to make it as authentic as possible. That's why we proposed it, we did not cut the edges, to see how, and here you can see how the book looks, and it's a very damaged stage, and it would be very difficult to use it, and we would be very hesitant to give it into your hands, you know, we prefer if you use it like this. Or here in this book is the famous story, who's that? So our necklace is our first project we started. It's a historic collection, and it's used, of course, by people who are in either Yiddish language or the life of Jews, mostly before the emancipation. And the second project is we're doing is Compact Memory, where we digitized our Jewish periodicals, because this periodicals is a different way that most people, they don't need the whole journal. They just need one article in one special copy. And then they have to write to us or to phone us, and we have to send it to them. And the difference is also that most libraries don't have today any more complete sets of all the copies of one periodical. We didn't either. So it was a joint project, and we put it together. So by putting it together, this project is not only like the first, a different technique, but you're like creating a collection that doesn't exist anymore like this. There is no library who has this collection in reality on the shelf. We had it before the war, but now today we have missing parts, or we have parts only, let's say one part is in paper, the other part is microfilm, because we bought it as a microfilm. And by this way, you're creating a new library. You're putting again together the journals in their completeness.
That's how it looks.
You can go, and you have two ways of using it. You can, on one hand, like use it like you would use the paper copy. You can browse through it. You have on the one side, you have a list of all the journals. It's about 120 journals from the Allgemeine Zeitung des Judentums until Zion, so from I to Z. You have all different streams of Judaism, all your culture, your science, your religion. Whatever was printed in these years, so you can like open your journal and you can read it online, browse through it, but of course you can, because it's a database, you can only search, you can put in words, and then you get results, you can use it also as a database. So there are two different ways.
And here you see, this is one example, chapter 3, Menorah, which was an illustrated monthly for the Jewish home, and it said,
you could open it and then you could go from page to page.
Is it an English book or a German book?
That's German. It's just an English title. It's
okay.
A German periodic. Most of the periodic, they all, there is, I don't think there is any English in it. There is a Hebrew, of course, some parts, and there is German, mostly.
And the collection, we didn't call it German Jewish periodicals, it's Jewish periodicals of the German speaking area. So it's not Germany of today, but it's the historic Germany, of course. Austria-Hungary, and we got many periodicals also from the National Library in Vienna.
And it's a pity, even now we are caught by people and said, oh, I have this journal, for example, in Budapest. It's in German from the Jewish community. Could you put it too? But now we don't have any money anymore. I'm trying to get more money. This was a finance for 6 years. So we have this 120 periodicals on. And if I get more money, then I think we can enlarge it, because I know it's used very, very frequently all over the world. So here you see, you open it and you look through the paper. Or this, for example, Jüdische Presse, which was a periodical of the Orthodox segment from Vienna, Bratislava. Here you have the Frankfurt Jüdisches Gemeindeblatt, which is this I chose the very famous page of 33 when it says when Nazis came to power, so it's written, if no one in this town will speak for us, then the stones of this town will speak for us, because we've lived here so many years. As I said at the beginning, the characteristics of Frankfurt is that it has a long old Jewish history. Or you can search. You can put in something, for example, and I have here put in Herzl, Jürgen Herzl, but I did not want wherever he wrote something or something was written about him, but I just wanted to have the possibility of choosing what you're looking for. You can look only for illustrations. So you have 100,000 of pages, look through for an illustration of Herzl, for example. And then you would get only 15, as you saw, 15 places, and there, for example, here you have Herzl when he was, you know, a young boy, and this famous picture. This is a photo montage in Basel. And because he had such a success with this compact memory, the periodicals online, which we have about 500,000 hits a month, people are really using it a lot. We got the money now to digitize the books of the collection, the whole pre-war collection, not in Hebrew letters, but in Latin letters. That's what we call the Mertjudaica collection, Frankfurt. So then all the books will be online, and you will be can read it or print it out. Today it's still a database in progress. We started it 2 years ago. There are about 18,000 booklets, prints. About 2 million pages. I don't know, we have funding for 4 years, we'll see how far we get. Today we have it about 3,000 titles already online. And it's a work in progress, you can see. You can see here on the left side, this is the classification of Freimann of his catalogue. Freimann succeeded in 1932, before he had to leave in 1933 the library. He succeeded to publish the catalogue of his collection, or of the collection, which is called the Freimann catalogue. So we know what was there, even if parts are missing because of the war, and we try to get these parts from other libraries. His catalogue is a catalogue not according to ABC, but to topics. So we took his classification, we did not change it. And the numbers in the parentheses are the books from these chapters that are already online. So hopefully, if you check every second day, there should be more and more, because they have librarians who can put in the titles. Books are digitized. And then automatically the numbers grow and grow, and you can look. So here you have, for example, that's how it looks. This is just I want to show at the end. This is how this project looks. You have the title of the book, and then in this database you can click, of course, onto the book, and then you would read it. You can print it, you can download it, but you can do also other things. For example, you can check where it says Verfasser, which means author. This W is Wikipedia, so if somebody would be in Wikipedia, there is so you can get the biography of this person. And you can be connected to our library and get the modern literature to the same topic. So you have the old source, because of course the books are only until 1932, and we are only allowed to put into the computer, of course, books which have no copyright. So we do put the old books when we know.
So none of them have copyright?
No. They're copyright free, of course, because otherwise, you know, I would be in jail, I guess, not here.
So you see it's all different. Here, for example, that's the law connected to this conference about Hirsch, that it made it possible for Hirsch to leave the community and to found his own community. His own community.
Okay, well, mentioned before that this is also a German Latin letter. German
yes.
Text. Why was that decision made as opposed to including some 18th or 19th century or 16th century Hebrew text?
Yes, we have, but we need a framework. So the framework was his catalog. So I can say I do the same thing as I did with the because I'm trying to reconstruct the historic collection that doesn't exist anymore. And because he has this, we have the catalog, and the books are partly destroyed or not in our collection, the catalog today is used as a bibliography. Right? So we use it as a bibliography. If somebody needs sources before 32, he can go and people go to this catalog and look it up.
So his catalog was only German language?
His catalog, no, was European languages.
Oh,
European.
Okay.
European, right. Yes, because in library, what happens is that in a library, you divide your collection according to the letter. That's why it's called Judaica and Hebraica. It doesn't mean the context. The moment that the book is in a Latin letter, then it's Judaica. The moment it's in a Hebrew letter, Hebrew, then it's Hebraic. And that's why Yiddish, from the context, it's like, you know, Yiddish history. But from the books, it's part of our Hebraic collection.
Is there a catalog?
Of the Hebraic collection, no. The Hebraic were destroyed most in the Hebrew books, and the collection and the catalog was also destroyed. When I started working in 90 in this library, I was looking for the catalog because I said, you know, maybe, because it says, I've read that he was about to print two parts. That's how libraries they divide. So he printed he published in 1932, he published the Judaica catalog, and he was about to publish the second volume, which would have been the Hebraica, but because he was thrown out of the library in 1933, and the Nazi came to power, he did not manage to do this anymore. So it always says also in his letters that the catalog was about to be published. I was looking for it, but I couldn't find any trace of it. So I think it was maybe stored together with the books, and most of the Hebrew books, besides the historic collections we have, they were destroyed during the war. So also the catalog is lost. So it's very difficult. There are possibilities to reconstruct the collection, because Schocken, because he wanted to bring it to Jerusalem, made a copy, and these are possibilities, but it's very difficult. But the Judaica catalog we do have in his form. And then it's also, then you have a historic collection that you put together again how it was before the war, right? So now I'm just showing you nice title pages of the books that we have. This is the school of the Jewish community, the Philanthropin in 1804, the Reform School, which was founded in 1804 and was one of the reasons why the Orthodox had to found their own school and to lead the community.
You see, it's just different kind of books. This is a book to learn German, you know, and this is a very general topic, but in the interesting thing is printed in Rödelheim, which was a very famous place where Hebrew books were printed. And this at the end was Martin Buber. So, this is the collection. If I get money, I try to digitize more and more, but this way we know that it's used by many people who don't come to our library, but who do it through the internet, because of course you have statistics and you can see that it's used. So if you have any questions, thank you.
I'm curious about the money, about the funding. So what percentage of the funding actually comes from the German government? What comes from the Jewish community?
From the Jewish community comes nothing, because this is by purpose like this, because this is a university library. And this is the difference, I would say, of the 19th century and today, which shows you also the history, that in the 19th century, the Jews of Frankfurt, they were Frankfurters, as we call them. They understood themselves, and there was, like here in Canada and in the States, there was a very large sentiment for your town, and you were used to be philanthropists, to give money. But the German state is normally formed like this, that you expect the state to pay, and not you. So there is very, generally, there is very, very few
or there's a very, let's say, a very small percentage of private investment in public institutions, because people expect not to do it by themselves. It slowly starts now because the state is in financial problems over many years, so they're starting to raise this personal interference or the personal attribution to the town. But for the Jews, we are now in Frankfurt, like 60 years after the war, and the community, I think, is how to say, a very solid community, and most people feel at home in Frankfurt. But they know that their grandparents, parents, grandparents, they didn't come from Frankfurt. It's a community where the people came from East Europe, from Israel, from wherever. Now we have many immigrants from the former Soviet Union. So they don't have the sentiment for university library. See, if they would give money, they would give money to the school, they would give money to the Jewish school, they would give to the community institutions. But they would not give money, they would give money to Israel. They give a lot of money to Israel, but they would of course not give money to university library. So it's very, so from the Jewish community we don't expect. But we expect from the German government, because we are not only for Frankfurt, but we are for the whole of Germany responsible to provide the literature. So we get about 80% of our funding from the German, which is very generous, because we don't have enough manpower to use all the funds. I mean, I don't have enough librarians who could, let's say, who could sit the whole day just looking where are Jewish books published. I mean, of course you have book dealers, you have publishers, you have ways trying to get offers, but there is a limit to, you know, 8 hours a day where you can work about. So I'm sure there are some books which I don't know of and which I could buy. So whatever, every year I ask for money from the German government, I make a proposal, and until now they've always given, you know, these are proposals which are in a round, because, you know, it's not like that 10 people are sitting and trying to buy billions worth of books. And the libraries and the university is paying about 20%, because they say that's for our students. Right? The rest is for the whole Germany, that's the government. I mean, it's the same books, but that's how we are. We have a center, not, we have a very small department of Jewish studies in Frankfurt. So most of the books are used, you could say, or most of the books come from our Frankfurt. And we have also scholars with historic collections from Israel or from the States. Thank you.